We're taking this also. We're also going to Houston.
Okay.
So whenever
I'm ready to go now. I just want to tell people.
Let's go ahead and take it over.
And go. Pardon me?
That's a finish, yeah.
I want to go.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll take your seats, we'll get started with the briefing here this morning on this subject. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I introduce myself. My name is Roy Ryder with McDonnell Aircraft. In this coming Gemini 6 mission, as you know, the prime object mission is the rendezvous with the Agena. Simultaneous launch and the orbital mechanics is the prime mission. Since this gets into a lot of different aspects, and in order for you to receive a understanding of what it all is involved and some of the terminology, some of the aspects involved, we have thought it best to carry on and explain this situation. To do this, we have with us this morning Mr. Bob Burton, our Chief of Electronics for McDonnell here at Cape Kennedy, to present to you a briefing on orbital mechanics, the rendezvous for Gemini 6. At this time, to get started, I'd like to present to you Mr. Bob Burton. Bob?
Put this thing on and round your neck.
You can.
I think I saw that one. Well, this will be a very general description of a complicated field. The idea of objects being in orbit has become fairly well accepted, and I think, in fact, even fairly well understood. So I'll only spend just a few brief moments talking about why objects go into orbit. Really, we're talking about a compromise between two natural laws. One of these laws says that if we have an object in motion, that object tends to maintain its same direction and velocity. Anybody that's been in a skidding automobile has had that experience. So conceivably, if we put an object in orbit or inserted with a very high velocity here above the Earth with only this law, then that object would continue on in some straight line going out into space. The other law, however, is gravity, and that says that an object at some height has to fall towards the center of the Earth. So the net result is a compromise path which takes off in a direction such as this. If the velocity is extremely high, then we have an escape trajectory such as our Mars shot. If the velocity is not high enough, then the object will re-enter. But when the velocity is just right, we enter into an Earth orbit. This covers a range of velocities from about 26,000 feet per second down to something on the order of 17,000 feet per second as we get very high. The velocity that is associated with the idea of keeping an object in order varies somewhat with the altitude involved. If we start up here at about 25,000, 20, 15, and look at a altitude up to, say, 6,000 miles, then the velocity required would vary something like that. In other words, at low altitude, the average velocity of the object is higher. Well, that then makes it fairly obvious that if we have an object in a higher altitude orbit, that since its velocity is slower and since its distance to travel per revolution is obviously greater, then the time for one orbit at a higher altitude is going to be greater than for a similar object at a lower altitude. Now, this technique is used to advantage in the Gemini Rendezvous mission to perform what we call a catch-up maneuver. If the Agena target is at a higher altitude, we inject the Gemini at a lower altitude. The position, say, at the time of insertion would be here, and say we are here. Then, by the time this object has made one revolution, we have finished one revolution and started a little bit on the second one, so we have reduced the range. So by the simple process of just staying in orbit at a lower altitude, if we are trailing the target, we can then catch up in a matter of time. We, of course, would still have the altitude difference to take care of. The path of the orbit falls into the general class known as ellipses, and the circle is just a special case of the ellipse. Now, the lowest point, as I'm sure everyone knows, is called the perigee. And the high point is called the apogee. And the velocity will be different at these two points. The velocity at the low altitude point is considerably higher than it is at apogee. And the situation is pretty much analogous to a car going up and downhill. As you coast downhill, you speed up. The idea of maneuvering in orbit can also be fairly well illustrated by looking at the apogee and perigee points. If we change our velocity at perigee, then we're going to change the altitude of our apogee, and vice versa. If we increase our velocity at perigee by roughly 1.8 feet per second, we will raise our apogee altitude by roughly 1 mile. Conversely, if we slow down at perigee, we will lower our apogee about 1 mile.
That same figure, Bob, 1.8 feet per second. Is that what you said, our burn of 1.8 seconds? I didn't understand what you said. You said you
it's a
foot change there at 1.8 for a mile.
Okay, the approximation is a velocity of 1.8 feet per second will give an altitude of 1 mile.
That's increase at perigee.
Right, if I increase the velocity at perigee, I increase the altitude at apogee. Conversely, if I am at apogee and increase my velocity, then I will raise the perigee altitude. And it's about the same amount. 1.8 at apogee will raise the perigee about 1 mile. Well, at any altitude within the range that we normally consider for manned spaced orbits.
Why does it have to be done at apogee or perigee?
It doesn't have to be done at apogee or perigee, but it is more efficient to do at these two points. Because all it requires at that time is merely an increase or decrease in your velocity vector.
If you would, I have certain questions for the benefit of the Houston people who are also listening. When you have a moment, would you try and repeat some of the questions so that they can hear what the questions are to give you an answer?
Certainly.
Right.
Well, the question in this case was, why does a maneuver have to be performed at apogee or perigee? And the answer is that it does not. But it is a very efficient place, an efficient point to make your maneuvers, because you can get wide variations in altitude merely by speeding up or slowing down. If you make a similar maneuver someplace else in orbit, you can accomplish the same effect, but you have to add some velocity in the vertical direction to maintain the same axes for your elliptical orbit. In other words, your perigee point would shift if you merely applied velocity someplace else along the orbit. Well, this same characteristic is again used to advantage in the Gemini mission. If you recall, the flight plan is to insert the Agena into a circular orbit at about 161 miles. And we will insert the Gemini into an elliptical orbit, which will initially be about 87 miles at perigee and about 146 miles at apogee.
You're talking nautical now, aren't you?
Nautical miles, right. At the time that we insert, the Agena will be approximately 1,000 miles ahead of the Gemini if everything goes according to plan. By merely staying in this orbit, as I pointed out, the second time around, that range would be reduced to about 600 miles. When we get to the perigee on the second revolution, we're going to add a velocity of roughly 54 feet per second. And using the 1.8 figure, you can see that that would raise the perigee altitude about 30 nautical miles. So our orbit then becomes still an ellipse, but with the perigee increased 30 miles. And because the average altitude has been increased, the catch-up rate will be slightly decreased. So that at the time that we reach third apogee, our range will be about 140 miles with the Agena. When we reach third apogee, we will add another delta V. This time, I think it's about 52.
Well, excuse me, before you go any farther. Sure. Now, this is the 600-mile difference here. This is at the beginning of the second orbit.
Yes, the question
is about your, that would be your...
about perigee point. The question was, where did the 600-mile range apply? And the answer for the normal mission is it's about the second perigee for the spacecraft.
The 140 is around at your second apogee?
At the third apogee.
Well, you got an orbit and a half.
Right. I go one orbit, staying in a 117, or rather in an 87-146. I go another orbit to get to apogee. I add 54 feet per second to put me into a 117, 146 elliptical orbit. I go an orbit and a half there, such that at third apogee, the range is about 140 nautical miles. Yes?
About one point you wrote out in your earlier briefing that you didn't make here that might help you.
That's a very good point. At any point in orbit, if you make a maneuver, the resulting trajectory will be forced to come back through that same point. In other words, I can change my velocity, but it takes time to make that velocity change turn into a distance. So if I am at this point and make a maneuver, I will change my orbit, but the new orbit will also come back through that point. So on these maneuvers where I apply them at apogee, then the new apogee remains unchanged. Okay, at third apogee, we add the additional 52 feet per second, and this will raise the orbit about the perigee about 29 miles, which brings us to 146 mile perigee, 146 mile apogee, or we're in a circular orbit, which is about 15 miles below that of the Agena. This then puts us in a position where we are still catching up slowly, but it also puts us in a position where the relative geometry between the two vehicles is relatively invariant. Our altitude difference, in other words, stays at a constant 15 miles. Might point out that if the Agena orbit turned out to be something less than perfect, in other words, it was elliptical, then all of these maneuvers would be modified somewhat so that at the point where we would normally go circular, we would then go into an elliptical orbit, which would nominally be about 15 miles below that of the Agena.
Bob, you were talking about 140 miles going back to your third apogee here. This is a 53 foot per second increase nominal?
Yes.
Flight plan calls for it at 2 hours and 18 minutes and 14 seconds.
Okay, so we're going about,
well,
it's 90 minutes per rev, so the second apogee would be 180 plus 45, about 220 feet per second, yes. Well, that second apogee, we changed to an elliptical orbit. Is that the one you're reading?
Yeah, 53 feet per second would be here.
Okay, see if there isn't another one at third apogee then.
You changed it to your elliptical orbit there.
Yes.
You don't know what...
2 feet per second
and
third
apogee. Yes. Okay, so far this discussion has been single plane. In other words, we have been looking at a cross-section of the Earth and the orbit. The other aspect, of course, is looking at this thing from the edge. This is a fairly simple picture. The edge of that plane, where we're orbiting like this, will always go through the center of the Earth. The laws that apply here are not affected by the gravity vector. So when we start talking about maneuver that will change the plane of the orbit, we fall back to the single law that a particle in motion will tend to go in that same direction. So we're tooling along at about 25,000 feet per second in some plane, and if we want to change that plane, we have to, by brute force, rotate that velocity vector. So let's assume that we want to go to some new plane. The only way you can get there is to add some velocity. If you remember vector algebra, I'll end up with a new velocity vector here, which will also be 25,000 feet per second by adding some delta V. Now the rule of thumb on that one turns out to be about 440 feet per second per degree. In other words, this gets to be a real expensive process if I want to change the plane of the orbit, which I think kind of brings us logically to the idea of launch windows. Have to make sure it brings us logically here. If I get messed up, perhaps the best way to get to this would be to take a look at this globe where I have cut out a circle of cardboard here that we'll use to represent the orbit plane. And I don't know whether you can see Florida or not, but we have to visualize a launch. In this case, let's assume that it's the Agena. launched at about 10 o'clock in the morning. So the sun is about up there, which gives us the light side of the orbit. It's the back side of the orbit. The Agena will be launched generally due east, so it'll take a path out over the Canaries, come back across the equator about the west coast of Africa, come down across Australia, back up across Mexico, and should come right back over the Cape again, except for one minor problem. The Earth keeps rotating on us. So in the 90 minutes that it takes for the Agena to make one orbit, the Earth has rotated some 22 degrees, and I'm sure all of you have seen the orbit paths, little sine waves that step across the world. That's strictly due to the fact that the Earth is rotating out from under us. Let's imagine that we couldn't launch our Gemini right away, in fact, for several hours. So it goes around here about 6 o'clock, it gets dark. We end up here 12 hours later, and we're ready to launch. Okay, I still got to come out of the Cape. My orbit has still got to go through the center of the Earth. So if I take off like that, I end up with a great big angle between the orbit planes. And at my 440 feet per second, to take care of about 60 degrees angle that I have here, I have an impossible situation. And in fact, I have an impossible situation for angles much smaller than that. And the idea of launch window comes about from the point of view that if I'm willing to spend so much velocity to change planes, then I am only willing to change through a certain angle. And if I want to restrict the angle, then I have to restrict the time during which I can launch. So coming back here to 10 o'clock in the morning, if we rotate this thing as the Earth rotates, or better go in the right direction, you can see that for about 3 hours or thereabouts, the Cape stays generally within the orbit plane. Okay, we're going to launch Agena at about 10 o'clock. About an hour and a half later, we're going to launch Gemini. So that says for about an hour and a half, we're going to be relatively within the plane and still have enough velocity to accomplish our mission. In the case of the Agena, if this velocity is too much for the spacecraft, we can use the Agena velocity to help us with this plane change. Okay, I guess one thing I should point out is if we get the Agena off and we have real trouble, obviously if we go 12 hours, we said we couldn't do it, but if we go 24, then we bring the Cape back into about the same position with respect to the orbit, and we open up a new launch window. And the same thing on the following day, and we could go on for several days. In fact, we're only limited by the power available to the Agena. So I think there are about 5 days available for the launch, should we have a problem after Agena is inserted.
We would not be able to launch for other reasons. I think we shouldn't leave them with the idea that we would launch. We would have the capability of launching 5 days in a row, because I believe we can. Or am I incorrect there?
No, you're right. When I very casually spin the Earth and bring it back into the orbit plane, it's not quite that simple. And the idea of launch window is certainly beyond the scope of this discussion, primarily because I don't understand it. The question was, do we have a 3-day launch window? And you have to let me get the world out of my hands here and look.
Thank you.
Well, based on the orbital mechanics involved, we would have a launch window available every day for the following several days. Now, we're getting into some operational problems that I'm not really qualified to answer, but it would depend in many respects on where in the count we encountered our problem, because the recycle time, the requirements for defueling and refueling and what have you can then have a significant effect on what window you can make. So based on orbital mechanics, yes, we'd have a window every fifth day or every day for 5 days. But based on operational constraints, there might very well be reasons that we can't do it. I think I've touched on most of the orbital mechanics aspects of the mission. It might be worthwhile to just go back and briefly go through the nominal mission again, pointing out what's going to happen. I know one thing I neglected to cover. We talked about...
Bob, you were on this degree of plane standing here.
Yes.
Do we have in the nominal flight plan where there will be, I'm looking for it here, where there will be a plane adjustment
place? I'm sorry to interrupt just once more, but Houston, the guys in Houston are going to have a difficult enough time trying to understand this, because you are using these various models. And it's going to make a little bit inconvenience, but if you could pass this mic around, we'd sure appreciate it so they can hear your questions.
Okay, in this case, I'll repeat it. Is there a point where it's desirable to make a plane change maneuver, and specifically, where is it in the flight plan? To answer the first question, if we have an out-of-plane situation, and again, looking at the edge of the orbital planes, then this is the angle that we're talking about removing. And the only point that you can do that with a single maneuver is where the two planes intersect, which will also turn out to be about over the equator. So that is the most efficient place to make a plane change. Now, obviously you can do it in another fashion by making two maneuvers. If we are here, we can set ourselves on a path like that. It won't be like that. And make a second maneuver, which will then put us back in the other plane. But a single maneuver has to take place at the point where the two planes coincide.
Well,
what I'm getting at here, Bob, is if the mission is nominal, if you have a launch at 10 a.m. for Atlas Agena and you have a launch at 11:40:52 for Gemini Titan, on a nominal mission, is there any plane change that you need, or would you be in the same plane?
In that case, we would be in the same plane.
But if you're out of plane, if it's later or depending on the time of each launch, then you'd have to make a plane change, and it would be where the two orbits at their node across the equator.
That's right. And I'm sure you recognize that I oversimplified the insertion technique, and there will be techniques applied to the Agena insertion which will have the effect of setting our launch window back, in other words, by delaying their actual insertion until the Agena is far out over the Atlantic. They give us the effect of moving the plane back closer to the Gemini launch. There are also some steering techniques that we can use during the ascent phase of Gemini, which help to put us in the right orbital plane. And in fact, I'm sure you're all aware that for the first time, the Titan will be launched on a variable azimuth situation. Depending on where we are in the launch window, the actual launch azimuth for the Titan will start out north and move south as the window transpires. Yes, sir.
The so-called braking maneuver just prior to the terminal phase, the end of the terminal phase of rendezvous, is actually an acceleration, is it not?
No. Beg your pardon, it is. And in fact, that's understandable merely from the point of view of the two velocities. If our Agena orbit has typically been higher, then its average velocity has been somewhat slower than the Gemini velocity at the lower altitude orbit. In order to increase our altitude, though, we did accelerate our spacecraft, or at least we had a significant component that caused an acceleration. And when we reached that altitude, our velocity, because we've been going effectively uphill, if you'll allow me to use that analogy, will be reduced, and very likely our braking maneuver will also have a significant component of acceleration. But I might point out that there aren't real general rules that you can apply for either the initial maneuver or the braking maneuver, because that will depend on the initial range, starting and finishing and what have you, and the particular class of orbits that the Agena and Gemini are in prior to the time of the initial maneuver. That's a good point on the braking maneuver. I guess I left the mission still dangling at the third apogee where we were both circular. We circularized the Gemini orbit at third apogee at that time with a range of about 140 nautical miles. And if everything goes according to plan, roughly 30 minutes later, our inertial guidance system, our radar, computer, and platform combination has been processing the data, and it will be displaying a velocity command or a maneuver command to the pilots that they should insert that would start us on a path causing a collision with the Agena. At that time, the range, I believe, will be roughly 30 miles. The maneuver will then cause the Gemini to take a path that roughly 33 minutes later will coincide with the circular orbit of the Agena. Obviously, since we're on different orbits, we will have different velocities at that time, and the pilots will then put in the braking maneuver to bring us to the same velocity. We're at the same position, and consequently we're in the same orbit, and we're ready to dock. There's a point that may not be obvious. We launched here at about 10 o'clock. Oops. About 10 o'clock in the morning, the rendezvous will take place roughly on the fourth orbit, so that when we get ready to dock, we find that the spacecraft is out over the Pacific in good position for tracking from Hawaii, and also near the beginning of the day cycle. So this will give about 45 minutes of daylight to complete the actual docking maneuver, where the crew is relying on strictly visual cues to perform the maneuver. If for some reason the launch is delayed, such that at the time we insert, the Agena is much farther than the 1,000 nautical miles that I assumed, then we are obviously going to have to stay and catch up for a longer period of time, and the mission will be deliberately altered so that our catch-up will cause our rendezvous to occur on about the 16th orbit, or on the 16th orbit, which will again bring us back into good position for ground tracking and also for the day cycle on the docking maneuver. Well, that's about all I had in terms of quote prepared material. Entertain any questions you might have.
If from the viewpoint of this particular thing, if you set a priority for launching, the prime launching time each day would be better than the subsequent launching times in any day. Is that right? Do you understand what I mean?
Yes, I think I do.
In other words, that on the second day, the first 25-minute period would be better than the second period of the first day.
That's correct. The principal reason being the amount of fuel that would be required to perform the maneuver. And in general terms, we have to talk about spacecraft velocity, which will accomplish this plane change, which builds up as we slip through our window. So we start out with a launch on time. We have some very low velocity requirement for that. It climbs fairly rapidly. We then reach a point where we say we're not willing to spend any more spacecraft velocity to accomplish the plane change. So we drop that requirement back to zero, and we start requiring a maneuver from the Agena to accomplish the plane change. That also requires varying amounts of velocity, which build up fairly rapidly until we again reach the point where we are not even willing to spend the velocity from the Agena. At that point, there is a blind spot, which will roughly coincide to the period of, or enough time to finish out one orbit, and we will then come back into a position where you could again use spacecraft velocity for some short period of time. It would be larger than here.
And because of the change, because of the Earth's motion, would the prime time come at a different time each day?
Yes.
Can you give us what those times would be?
Well, I have a design note issued by NASA, which I believe is current. And well, for the first day, we're based on 11:41, which I believe is about what we're planning. On the second day, the prime time would occur at 10:10. On the third day at 8:52, second day 8:52. Third day, there are actually three possibilities. None of them are particularly desirable. One of these is at 10:24. And on the fourth day, 8:53.
What was the third one on the third day, Bobby?
Yeah, on the third day we have 8:48, 10:24, and 12 o'clock.
Was that 8:48 or
8:52?
8:48,
8:52 was the second day, I'm sorry.
What was 10:10?
First day, one day later.
Yeah,
I started off
at
zero.
10:10. Oh, I see. Okay. So actually these three are on the fourth day, is that what you're trying to say, and none are too desirable?
That's true. There are actually three.
Starting at zero launch day,
and then you go to the first day afterwards, 24 hours later, 10:10 a.m. All right, 48 hours later, is that the 8:52 a.m.?
Yeah.
Well, there's another window at 10:17.
10:17 now, is that 24 hours later?
48 hours later.
48 hours. Or 8:48, 10:17, let's go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Okay, we're on Wednesday.
Monday we're going to try and launch at 11:41.
All right.
Tuesday we would try to go at 10:10.
Okay.
Wednesday we would try to go at 8:58. Or 8:52, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Although we could go at 10:17.
10:17.
Okay.
Okay. Now what about Thursday?
Thursday at 8:48.
8:48.
Right, or again at 10:24.
10:24. Where did noon come in there?
Well, that was the third window on that date, 12 o'clock, right?
On the fourth day or on Thursday?
Yes.
Okay.
The 10:24 on Thursday would be the best one.
Then you have one day left?
The 8:48 on Thursday would be the...
Do you have one day left? Fifth day or Friday?
Now, let me again qualify that all of this information is based strictly on the orbital relationships and not on any operational constraints. But, yes, from a point of view of orbital mechanics, you would again on Friday have a shot at 8:53 and again at 10:29.
Okay. Is that the end of Agena? Wait a minute. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. Okay.
But let me emphasize that all of those times are subject to other constraints over and beyond the orbital mechanics. Yes?
Could you go into some of the mechanics involved in the plane change? You went through it very quickly, but the actual basic mechanics involved in a plane change.
Well, if it is a large plane change and to be performed by the Agena, then there is really only one logical place to do it, assuming, of course, that the Agena is in a position at that time that it can be controlled from the ground. If we look at the Earth and rough in the equator, the planes will typically be inclined about 29 degrees, corresponding roughly to the latitude of the launch site. And if they are different, then the intent will be to apply a velocity to the Agena at the point where the two planes intersect, which also roughly coincides with the equator. And that maneuver will be designed to make a vector which is 25,000 feet per second in magnitude change its direction so that it is again 25,000 feet per second in magnitude but rotated through some angle which corresponds to the difference between the two planes.
Can we assume then there should be absolutely no tumbling in the Agena?
Yes, the Agena is stabilized. It has its self-contained attitude control system, which maintains it in a generally horizontal direction and generally aligned with the orbit plane. Now, in order for the Agena to make its maneuver, it obviously has to get its thrust axis generally perpendicular to its velocity vector, and in fact generally perpendicular to the orbit plane. So to accomplish this, the ground will command a torquing rate on the yaw axis of the Agena, which will cause it to rotate roughly 90 degrees to the plane. It will then command a velocity magnitude, which the Agena controls using a velocity meter. And then at the time that the Agena is in this ideal location, namely just about crossing the equator, they will initiate this thrust period, and the Agena will burn perpendicular to the orbit and a magnitude sufficient to get the desired angular change, and then it will shut off. Then the ground will again command the Agena back into the normal orbital attitude, which we expect to have when we complete the rendezvous.
Can I ask a sort of a silly question? But in order to explain how much push goes into, say, a foot per second at either apogee or perigee, or how much retarding action, is there any human way to explain it? Like if you were standing in space, could you shove the thing a foot per second with your arms, or more than a foot per second? Is there some...
Well, of course, we're talking about a velocity change, so you would be more nearly correct if we talked about tendency for your head to snap back when you dart away in your Corvette. But
okay, that's all right. Anything that can explain it in terms of flesh and blood.
Okay, the acceleration in the spacecraft is about 1 foot per second per second, which is considerably lower than you would get in even my automobile. It will take about a 1 second burn from the spacecraft thrusters to get this velocity change. And in about 10 seconds in your automobile, you can get up to 60 miles an hour, which is 88 feet per second. So it's considerably greater acceleration in your automobile than the pilots will feel in space. Yes, sir.
No, I just want to ask you something. Scott Simpson. So he said if this was the plane of the Agena, and this is your launch azimuth, the Gemini, he said you'll start to lift off at about this point here and steer into the plane of the Agena, or you can do it on the backside.
Okay.
Steering. And if this gives you
the launch window.
Well, is that the 17 minutes that is due to the due to biasing the azimuth of the Agena, or is this the total 25 minute window?
No, it's actually neither. It's this period is restricted actually by range safety.
And how wide is that? Is that the 25 minute window?
I don't have that answer directly, but it's I think about 30 to 40 minutes.
Could you tell me why on Thursday we see three launch windows in less than 2 hour intervals, but it appears only on Thursday? We have 8:48, 10:24, and 12.
Yes, it gets back to this initial situation where I, and in fact, it's related to the one that we discussed on the board, but we are talking about a period of time where the orbit plane contains the Cape for a period of time of about 3 hours. Now, on the particular case where we have three launch windows, The launch window is a function of two things. One, where the plane lies with respect to the launch site, and I've already stated that for roughly 3 hours a day, we have a situation where the Cape goes through this plane. It also is a function of where in orbit the Agena would be at that time. So if we end up with the ideal situation where we are just coming into the plane at about the same time that the Agena is passing overhead, then we'll have another opportunity 90 minutes later and still a third opportunity 90 minutes beyond that.
Essentially, because of the position of the Agena.
Right. That would allow us to make a rendezvous four of it later.
Could you explain on the board that business of the Immelmann boost?
Yes, the question was, could I explain on the board the idea of the Immelmann, which I believe the flight crew used in their description of the rendezvous maneuver. Not really knowing what an Immelmann is, it may be a little tough, but I think this is what they have in mind. If you imagine that we have a coordinate system located in the target, then we have one coordinate, which will be the altitude difference between the Gemini and the Agena, and another coordinate, which would be range. And if you look at the path that the spacecraft will follow as it completes its rendezvous, it is something like this during the terminal maneuver, where this is the braking maneuver. Prior to this point, it is a series of cusps like that. And I believe that it is this curve that they were referring to when they talked about an Immelmann, which brought them into the docking attitude.
Bob, if everything goes according to schedule on the third apogee, you're going to make a change to 52, bringing it to 146 perigee, 146 apogee. Will that be the final change to bring the Gemini on course with the Agena?
No, that maneuver will merely bring us into a circular orbit, which is about 15 miles below the orbit path of the Agena. Then, when the onboard guidance system has processed its data to determine the necessary maneuver to complete the maneuver, we will again thrust, and it will be roughly 30 minutes after the maneuver that you talked about. That would coincide to this point, and it would start us on this collision path. Then, as we approach the Agena with some relative velocity, the pilots will observe this velocity on their cabin instrumentation and will reduce it to zero, and that brings us at the same velocity and the same position, a few feet apart.
Was trying to recall where the Agena, in this program, where the Agena has been tested to for these maneuvers and acrobatics. Where do we go back for that?
I'm afraid I can't answer.
Does anyone know?
This is effectively a production type Agena.
Could you show us what a Hohmann transfer is?
Well, generally I can. The Hohmann transfer is the maneuver that will most effectively take you from one orbit to another. Now, if we have two orbits, both ellipses, and if the semi-major axis for both ellipses is coincident, then the Hohmann transfer would be a maneuver at perigee which would add velocity to raise us to this apogee altitude, and another maneuver at apogee which would add velocity to raise the perigee to the same altitude. The maneuver gets much more complicated if the two ellipses do not share the same major axis, and again, because I wouldn't dare attempt the mathematics, I wouldn't dare attempt the maneuver. But
is a Hohmann transfer necessarily a minimum energy transfer?
I believe it is, but I'd certainly have to qualify my answer. I don't know that much about it.
Bob, you have a film racked up back here. Is this film on animated, showing the sequence or something? Rendezvous. What does it tell you?
Yes, the film is generally covers the Gemini mission, and will probably do a better job than I have of.
Well, I was just going to suggest, if we were going to see that, maybe perhaps we could look at it and then get back to questions after, because it might clear up a lot of this and save a little time.
Well, since I'm running out of answers,
no.
A good idea.
We're just getting far afield here.
Well, is that all right with everybody? Then we'll move to the film, and I'll stick around, and if there are more questions, we can pick it up.
I might say that in the beginning there's a little tie-in with the
successfully launched America's manned space exploration program. These flights demonstrated the and above all, that an astronaut could perform competently in space for reasonably short periods of time. With the expansion of the manned space exploration program, however, there grew a need for an advanced spacecraft, a vehicle that could develop the equipment and techniques for later manned Earth orbital, lunar, and planetary missions. One that could form a broad base of spaceflight experience, making long-term missions, rendezvous, two-man crews, maneuvering, and controlled re-entry a routine matter in space. This project was called Gemini. Many of its advanced capabilities is in-space rendezvous, the joining of two orbiting vehicles. The first phase of the rendezvous mission is already underway. A target, an unmanned modified Agena vehicle, launched earlier by Annapolis, is in a circular orbit over 150 miles above the Earth. If necessary, its engine can be
short movie has arrived that NASA has that was specifically made for the particular burns involved on this, and they'll be showing it, I believe, sometime subsequently. So if now you have anything further you'd like to ask of Bob, why he's available here.
Maybe before we start the questions, I ought to point out specifically that the film showed a launch into a launch at a apogee altitude, which coincided with the Agena. If you recall, we no longer do that. We go to a lower altitude. The original concept showed us with a rendezvous based on optical tracking of the Agena. I'm sure you're all aware that the primary rendezvous technique utilizes the radar, but the backup technique was very influential in determining the relative trajectories prior to starting the rendezvous. And that, in a large part, explains the differences between present mission plans and the mission techniques shown on the film. Any questions? The other film, if it's the one that I recall, is much more detailed on the actual orbital mechanics.
Do you have the film there now?
No, I don't. Thank you. Thank you all very much, gentlemen.
No problem. Here's your other mic.
Broadcast Venice, carriage out. Broadcast finance at Carriage House.
Hope so, so.
Broadcast fan, this is the Carriage House. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Broadcast fan, this is the Carriage House. Ain't that all right? Can I listen to me if I want to?
No, he can't talk.
You're darn right. I can't hear what I'm saying.
Good. Good. Now we got something for FM.
Broadcast man, this is the Carriage House.
Hey, can we bring us in
an 8,500
here on Earth?
Hey, man, we
got to
equalize
ourselves
with the broadcast man.
Broadcast man, this is the Carriage House.
Come on. Bootleg, because I can do whatever they
want. Are you there?
Call on the phone. Come up on this net.
Why not? Go. Go, broadcast van. I can hear Houston right now. What'd you say? Broadcast van?
Go ahead, Jazz. You can call me.
Right. Did you get all that?
Get all what?
Did you get any of that press briefing?
No.